Hello, good evening, and welcome. I'm Merlin Drag, and this is In Our Time. From their inception, libraries have served as places for learning. They have stored and preserved knowledge, produced new thinking, and helped to enact identity, both cultural and individual. They have been a source of exploration by historians, and contributed to the education of future generations. At the same time, libraries and the act of collecting have frequently been a tool of conquering cultures, who have used the pillaging of artifacts, literature, and ideas as a means of asserting dominance and social control over subjugated communities. Joining me today are Nancy Downs from Drexel University's College of Computing and Informatics, where she is a librarian and sessional lecturer specializing in social justice, Griselda Sparshot, liaison librarian to the Department of Near and Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Illinois, and a volunteer information professional for Librarians and Archivists with Palestine, which we will refer to as LAP. Also joining us is Philippa St. Francis Cresswell, assistant professor in the Sociology Department of Sydney University, Australia. Naomi Klein has stated that librarianship is a radical vocation. Nancy, how has this been demonstrated through the history of the profession?
Well, to an extent, social justice has always played an important role in library and information practices. The Public Libraries Act in 1850 emphasized free access as well as the library's ethical duty to elevate the moral standards and intellectual well-being of the communities they served. However, we don't actually see any of this ethos or ideology being extended to the needs of underrepresented or marginalized groups until the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Which is when libraries and legislators began developing policies that facilitated access to information within these communities.
Can you point to a specific example for us?
In 1964, Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Library Services and Construction Act. The act initially pledged $55 million of annual federal aid to public libraries. The New York State Library was then able to use almost $700,000 to develop services for disadvantaged neighborhoods. Similarly, the signing of the Higher Education Act the following year led to increased funding for libraries and educational institutions. So, in essence, both of these acts allowed libraries to develop services and collections for disadvantaged and underserved groups.
Now, Griselda, how does the LAP fit into this movement as a radicalized organization?
Well, Librarians and Archivists with Palestine is a global network of information professionals who work in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for self-determination, and in solidarity with Palestinian archivists, librarians, and academics in the interest of providing support for their projects and developing a mutual exchange of ideas. Our work began with our first delegation in 2013, during which we traveled to Palestine in an attempt to learn more about problems of access to information under what is referred to as Israeli occupation, as well as projects created to combat these barriers.
Could you just talk a little bit more about the barriers?
Yes. Many important cultural and historical materials have been co-opted by Israeli archival institutions and thus are restricted or completely inaccessible to Palestinians. For example, much of the private book collections of those who were displaced in 1948 were collected and added to the National Library of Israel at Hebrew University. These books are currently classified under the designation abandoned property.
How does the estrangement of the cultural production of knowledge affect identity? I understand Australia has been wrestling with this.
Yes, we can certainly discuss the stolen generations. Indigenous children affected by a policy of cultural assimilation put into motion by the Australian government from the late 19th century up until the 1970s. Children of Indigenous heritage would be forcibly taken away from their families and put into state or church-run institutions and homes. The policy aimed to cut the children off from their Indigenous culture, identity, and worldviews. Thus, assimilation would attempt to encourage mass forgetting of a traditional Indigenous way of life, which was a primarily oral culture.
How did information professionals react or respond to the community-driven need for access to identity via information and knowledge?
When the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Protocols for Libraries, Archives, and Information Services, known as the Protocols, were written, they emphasized reaching out to Indigenous communities and building ties on mutual respect and treating materials related to these peoples with sensitivity. In libraries, this often translates into making Indigenous materials and perspectives more widespread.
Does this involve the participation of Aboriginal peoples? Is it custodianship? Yes. What is the model?
So one of the practical offshoots or recommendations of the protocols is to include Aboriginal members on governing boards. Other things like caveats for racist language and catalog descriptions, and really encouraging librarians to be proactive in their role as educators, promoting awareness of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, cultures, and issues among non-Indigenous Australians.
What does the role of trust play in the act of reconciliation?
The protocols do state that they are not prescriptive or definitive. So what that means is they rely on librarians and other information professionals to put them into use. They're not enforced by law or anything resembling that. So because Australia is operating out of institutions and organizations that already exist and have existed in colonial Australia, they can be met with resistance. And as recently as 2005, a study showed that Indigenous people still had feelings of discomfort surrounding libraries because these information institutions, such as libraries, archives, etc., were initially used as surveillance, collecting all sorts of materials and cultural objects from Indigenous peoples and putting them behind closed doors, shutting them out, not giving them access to cultural documentation and materials.
What does the Australian model have to offer LAP?
Well, in some ways, the situation is similar in that Palestinians are experiencing the erasure of their culture and history, which really limits their movement towards self-determination. However, Librarians and Archivists of Palestine is coming from a sort of different position than the movements that are happening in Australia, in that we are not ourselves members of the Palestinian community, so we must be mindful of our modes of activism and recognize existing power dynamics without playing into them. Therefore, our practical philosophy very intentionally centers around solidarity and spreading awareness.
Could you tell us a little more about the practical programs in place with LAP?
Yes. So, in part, we are there to witness some of the projects that are happening in Palestine. So one that really demonstrates how Palestinian libraries and archives have become spaces of resistance is special collections of prisoners' documents in Nablus Public Library and the Abu Jihad Museum for Prisoners. These institutions document the experiences of political prisoners through the preservation of their political writings and letters and notebooks. We also spread awareness with our initiative One Book, Many Communities, which is an international reading campaign where we recommend one book a year related to Palestinian experiences for communities to read and discuss globally.
Is that discussed on digital platforms?
Mm-hmm. Well, we choose one day when everyone will get together to discuss. So there will be groups of people within communities discussing in person, and also there are Twitter campaigns to open up channels of communication.
The act of divorcing people from their cultural history while appropriating the tools of engaging with said culture has resulted in scholarship being directed from outside the community by those who may have a vested interest or agenda disconnected from neutrality. How do library ethics respond to this rupture?
Well, originally librarians were trained to be neutral. However, this is not actually recognized as a core value of the ALA. Instead, the ALA lists social responsibility as one of their core values of librarianship, and they define it in terms of the work that it can do in helping to solve the problems of society. Dr. Toni Samek from the University of Alberta has conceptualized what she calls critical librarianship. She defines it as an international movement of library and information workers that consider the human condition and human rights above any other professional concerns.
Can you tell us a little bit more about critical librarianship?
Her studies place the roots of critical librarianship in the 1930s U.S. progressive library movement, and she also draws a lot of attention to the ALA's expansion of the concept of intellectual freedom to include librarians themselves. Librarians, of course, are citizens too, so therefore they also have the fundamental right to their own freedom of expression, in addition to the responsibility for development and maintenance of intellectual freedom in libraries. And along with this comes the increasing belief that libraries must become more responsible for providing services and resources that foster social justice efforts in society, which is especially relevant today as social justice issues continue to increase.
Very interesting. Thank you for joining us in our discussion of the role of social justice librarianship and barriers to access. Please join us next week as we discuss masculinity in Arthurian Camelot. Lancelot, super stud or super dud?